There's a new book out about the Smiths called The Smiths, The Day I Was There. It tells the story of the band in the words of over 400 fans from Britain and the US, with memories of the earliest Smith shows at UK clubs to the last ever gig at London's Brixton Academy. You'll see a portrait of the Smiths from the perspective of fans, promoters and support acts, with photographs, memorabilia, anecdotes and stories that have never been published before, including, I believe, one with Simon Wollstonecroft. But here to tell me a little bit more about the book and how it came to be and some of the impact that the Smiths had during their surprisingly short lifespan is author of The Smiths, The Day I Was There, Neil Cossack. Neil Cossack, good morning to you. Good afternoon even to you, Neil.
Good afternoon, Giles. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Speaking to you from sunny Marbella. But are you in sunny Manchester today?
Oh, I'm actually in North Wales. I live in North Wales and it's freezing. I've been walking on the beach today with my massive coat on with the dogs. And I'm still warming up now.
So, the Smiths, and when people say iconic bands, the Smiths, if you weren't into that whole sort of big hair and big shoulder pads and were sort of north of Watford, I suppose, when the Smiths kicked off, they seemed to be talking to every kid in a sort of post-industrial town from sort of Watford upwards.
I think they did. They did seem to speak to people that sort of felt outside of society. And also, they seemed to come at just the right time. It was after punk, disco was dying out, the new romantics were getting tired, and they just seemed to be a space for them. And they just seemed to capture their own audience because they were so unique. I mean, they had a brilliant frontman in Morrissey, an actual sort of guitar genius in Johnny Marr.
Absolutely.
So, they were writing great songs as well. So I know, quite often when you mention the Smiths to people, they just go, oh, miserable, you know, but they weren't at all. They were a really upbeat, very interesting, great lyrics band who weren't around that long but made a massive impact.
I mean, I remember seeing Morrissey on Top of the Pops, because that's all you could probably get from Stoke-on-Trent in those days, but I remember seeing them on Top of the Pops, and, you know, the first time he had his gladioli, he was, you know, he had a shirt outside, and they were, you know, they were looked indie, and I mean, there wasn't an awful lot of indie really hitting the mainstream. I suppose it was really The Cure if you were looking for something a bit like that, but, you know, other indie bands were pretty much submerged under, like I said before, the sort of the big hair, you know, it was the mid of Duran, Spandau, all that lot, wasn't it, really?
It was, yeah, and there was something about the Smiths. They obviously had a unique look, and with, you know, Morrissey as the frontman, and Johnny Marr looked so cool as well. They just seemed to hit it, and they were making really great three-minute pop songs, which I think was refreshing at the time, because we had, musically, we were all over the place in the early 80s. It was a bit of a mess, wasn't it?
It was indeed. What were they like? I mean, I've talked about, you know, Marr's guitar playing, because he went on to, he's still touring, he's still playing, obviously, as is Morrissey, and the furore that over his recent T-shirt that he was wearing, which I can't actually say on live on air because I'll upset some people. But what, I mean, people tend to forget, the Smiths were a cracking live band as well, and that's what you've captured in the book.
We have. It's been really interesting working on the book because, as you mentioned before, Giles, there's over 400 fans have sent in their memories and also the influence that the Smiths had on them as, you know, young people, teenagers, students. And everyone says the same thing. They were an amazing live band, very intense. And, you know, they would combine a great set list. They knew how to work the crowd. They were very good as well. But they did. They just seemed to hit the mark at exactly the right time. And I find it interesting now how, I think it's fair to say, Morrissey has really fallen out of favour with an awful lot of people due to his comments.
Can I just say that's the understatement of the year so far, by the way, for that one, Neil. But yes, I'm with you on that one. It looks like everybody's embarrassing Uncle. You know, Uncle Moe's gone for it again.
He is, isn't he? But also, Johnny Marr has just sort of retained his coolness, and everybody seems to love Johnny Marr. I know he's just done a huge UK and European tour, I think.
Yeah.
And they do, you know, godlike genius. People really do admire Johnny Marr, which is fantastic, you know. It's been really interesting working on the book. You mentioned Simon Wollstonecroft in your intro, and he actually starts the book off because he was in a group with Johnny Marr before Morrissey appeared on the scene. And Simon tells this really great story how they auditioned Morrissey because Johnny Marr had met him, wanted him to join the band. So Simon was there when they auditioned him, and Simon just didn't get on with Morrissey at all. So he quit. That was it.
Yeah.
You know, he would have been the drummer in the Smiths. He actually went on to be the drummer in The Fall and also worked with Ian Brown from the Stone Roses and has had a very successful career.
I was going to say, that's not a bad trade-off, to be honest with you.
Yes, exactly. But I think it just goes to show that even from that early age, Morrissey was winding people up. And there's also in the book, somebody sent in, Morrissey used to write to the music papers all the time complaining about, you know, them not covering The Clash and The Sex Pistols and trying to promote his own band, The Smiths. And we do actually have a little cutting, I think it's from the NME, where Morrissey's complaining, saying that they're not covering the Sex Pistols enough. You know, they should be in there more, and they're the future of rock and roll, etc. But obviously, he is a very intelligent guy, Morrissey.
I mean, if you think about it, we are perhaps blessed then that, you know, in the mid 80s, that social media hadn't been invented, because otherwise Morrissey would have been tweeting to the music press on an almost secondly basis.
Right, the days were very different then, especially in Stoke-on-Trent.
Oh, I can tell you from that nothing. I can tell you that for nothing. But again, and it was interesting because the you know, the Bibles were, I remember, you know, NME, Music Maker and Sounds. Those were the papers that you got, and you got your badges too. But that's how people basically found about music, found out about gigs. So how did you go about, I mean, it must have been great fun getting hold of some, as a historical, I know it's something that we are in our youth, but some historical documents at that time, you know, concert reports and, you know, reports from fans who were there. How do you track Smith's fans down?
Well, basically, we use social media. We also, I think you know, Giles, we also run thisdaymusic.com, which is the, you know, the music information website, Trivia, etc. So, and we have a very big following on Facebook. So basically, that's our starting point. We do a post saying that we'd like to hear from fans of the Smiths for this book, if you'd like to share your story. And we're always inundated with responses, and of course they tell the friends, and it spreads on social media, and then you discover a lot of diehard fans that still have the copies or the cuttings from Sounds and Melody Maker and the NME tucked under their bed in a box somewhere, and also photos of them meeting the band as well, because it's one thing that becomes clear reading the book: the Smiths were really loyal with their fans, and they really like to meet the fans after the shows and talk to them. Morrissey, in the book, there's a few copies of letters that Morrissey wrote to fans. He was always writing to people. I think if you gave him your address or you wrote to him, he would write back to you, you know, which is fantastic. There's not a lot of people have ever done that, really. So that is a side of Morrissey that has come through in the book that shows he was very passionate about their fan base.
And if you listen to the lyrics, you can see why, because, you know, they don't drift off into talking about, you know, elves and goblins, or they don't talk off about, you know, while the rest of the thing was singing about Rio and dancing in the sand. I mean, Morrissey's talking about, you know, how soon is now? There's a club when you want to go and you can meet someone who really loves you, but you go and you stand on your own, you leave and on your own, and you go home and you cry and you want to die. That's not happy pop music, but that's the teenage experience.
It is indeed, and obviously it really touched a nerve with the younger generation, because his lyrics were fantastic, and as I mentioned before, joined that up with Johnny Marr's songwriting skills, and they were making great records. And it's funny, because they weren't around that long, were they? They only made four albums.
Yeah.
In a very short, I mean, 1982 to 87, I'm correct, I think, yeah.
Yeah.
That is a very short space of time for a band to be around, you know, when you compare it to lots of other bands.
Well, if you think about it, because they always say that, you know, that like, and I'm not saying the Smiths are a boy band or a teen band by anything of the imagination, but the average lifespan of a teeny band is a generation. So it's like from 11 to 16, 5 years. But then you look at an album like Meet His Murder, and nobody ever done that with an album cover before.
No, they certainly were breaking down barriers with a lot of things they did. Again, it was all, I know it was Morrissey that was in control of all the artwork and the how they wanted to present the band, and he was very clever at doing that, because they immediately had their own, their own style. In all the album sleeves, the single sleeves, all their adverts, you knew it was the Smiths as soon as you spotted it in a paper.
So one of the bits, I mean, because obviously you put this on social media, getting Smiths fans coming in saying, you know, I've got this, I've got that. How do you sort the Smiths wheat from the chaff, as it were?
Well, we try and include just about everybody who contacts us. So quite often people might just send in, you know, a bit of a one-liner. Yeah, I saw the Smiths in Blackpool, you know, in 1985, best night of my life. So we will then email them back or call them just to try and get more of a story out of them, you know, how old they were, you know, were they working, were they at college, were they at uni, were they living at home, you know, tell us a bit more about the gig. And then most people do then start to, you know, tell more of a story. Because let's face it, it's a long time ago, Charles, isn't it? I mean, I'm sure you can't remember a lot of detail from gigs you went to when you were 15 or 16.
Well, indeed. That's another book in itself, though, to be honest.
But that's what we do. And obviously, it's lovely because we've done a few of these books. You know, we've done one on Springsteen and Dylan and the Stones, and we've got a new one coming out on the Jam in a few weeks' time. And it's, we really enjoy working with the fans because it's great to get them in these books as well. They can, you know, share their memories. And it paints a very honest picture of the time as well, I think.
So what are the bits that made you sit up and take notice, and the bits that you did? I mean, apart from this great story about meeting, you know, Simon's meeting Morrissey and thinking, right, that's it, I'm off, I can't stand this Herbert. What are the things that strike you, that stand out for you?
Well, there's several stories in the book where people would travel everywhere to see them. They would go to practically every gig on a tour. They would just drop everything. Which is quite amazing. And it was those people that would get to know the band slightly, and they'd end up being on the guest list every night, so they didn't have to buy tickets. But you read some of those stories, and people were staying in youth hostels, having to scrounge money from the parents, sleeping on railway stations overnight and stuff. You know, the sort of the length some of these people went to go and see their idols is quite incredible, really. But I have to say, my favourite story in the book is from a guy, and I can't remember his name now, but he was a huge Smiths fan all through their career, but never got to see them. And he ended up working at Rough Trade Records quite a few years after the Smiths had split up. And he managed to get invited to a party that Morrissey was going to attend.
Right.
And he was so excited and, you know, so in awe about meeting his hero, he got so drunk. He eventually did meet Morrissey, and from the way he describes it in the story, he did that thing that the guy in Only Fools and Horses did. You know, when he leans on the bar and, and then he falls over.
But of course, the most famous moment in British comedy.
Yes, well, he did that, and apparently Morrissey just tutted and just walked over him because he was so drunk he made a complete fool of himself. So I do like the lighter stories like that. And there's also there's some great stories of, especially in, you know, Manchester, Salford, how a lot of the young guys would always just break into the venues. They'd climb in through toilet windows, never buy tickets and stuff, you know, to get to see the heroes. So it's interesting how fanatical people were and the length they would go to see the Smiths live, which is, I think, it's quite entertaining.
And you can make the point, and I'll go a little bit off message here because I know we're talking about the book, but the Smiths, kind of, I mean, apart from that sort of that legendary concert that the Pistols were at, you know, in Manchester, where apparently the whole, you know, basically the whole of the Manchester scene were there, from, you know, from Tony Wilson through to, you know, Mick Hucknall to everybody else. But I mean, the Smiths are really the forerunners of putting Manchester on that music scene, with a different music scene that then turns into Manchester, Stone Roses, and then keeps going through the Hacienda.
You're spot on there, Giles. I mean, that is dead right. They did do that because obviously we'd had, I'm from Manchester myself, and we'd had some great bands, but you don't really, or you didn't really associate Manchester as sort of a groundbreaking musical hub, did you, at all? The Smiths definitely were the first to do that, and you're right, they, you know, sort of became part of that Hacienda and Manchester scene. And sort of laid the foundation, I suppose, for a lot of Manchester bands to come through.
Do you think, you know, I mean, we're talking about 30 years later, but I mean, we are talking still about Morrissey because of, you know, his recent exploit, and he kept himself in these news. And Johnny Marr, again, he went on to do a brilliant album with The Other called Dusk, which is just, I think, an outstanding album. But it shows something of their influence, that we're still talking about the Smiths 30 years later in a way that we're not talking about sort of Teardrop Explodes or Echo and the Bunnymen, who were, to a certain extent, The Cure, because they burned brightly. They made their impact then, and then they sort of blew out.
I think so. I could be wrong on this, but I've got a theory that when, you know, you reach that certain level of a cult following, or, you know, quite a mainstream following, and then you stop, you end it, and there's never any chance of you reforming. The same with the Jam. I think your cult status just grows and your legacy grows and grows, because it's not like you would now. I mean, I couldn't imagine going to see the Smiths now, could you? You know,
I can't imagine Morrissey and Johnny Marr on a stage together, to be honest with you.
No, exactly. Now, the Jam, I think, you know, possibly, I don't think it will ever happen, but, you know, Bruce Foxton is obviously still playing in from the Jam. Rick Buckler, I've been lucky enough to work with Rick, and he's such a lovely guy. It would work, I think, the Jam, but I know Weller's never going to do it.
Yeah.
But I think that's good, and it's the same with the Smiths. I think knowing that you will never see those four guys on stage ever again just sort of adds, I think, to the mystique and the legacy that they laid out.
Yeah, I mean, they're of their time. They capture their time. I mean, going to see the Jam now and them looking like pretty much, I mean, the Modfather looks like the Modfather still, but, you know, but the rest of them looking like, no, I don't mean in a bad way, but, you know, South London boys and, you know, maybe sort of pub landlords or whatever. I mean, so you want to remember Bruce Foxton, you know, sharp suited, and you want to meet, you know, and as well, you want to meet them, you know, young and sharp suited, and the same with the Smiths, because they capture that period of time quite perfectly, as your book does.
Yeah, I think so. I agree. So I think there's a lot to be said for never reforming. Rolling Stones, well, they never split up.
They never split up. They keep going.
You see, like Led Zeppelin will never reform, I'm sure, which is great, because I think it just adds to the mystique. But there's nothing wrong with, I mean, it was great to see The Cure at Glastonbury, and they were fantastic. And you just accept that, sure, they're now all men in their late 50s and early 60s, and that's the way you look when you get to that age, you know. Yeah. I know, because I'm 61. So, yes.
Believe me, friends of mine went to see Sweet the other couple in the summer, and that was quite a frightening prospect as well, but they've never really gone away. But the thought of the Smiths reforming, let's keep it as it is. The book is called The Smiths, The Day I Was There. It's out now. If people want to find out some more information about you, about the great website, and a little bit about this particular project, where can they go, Neil?
They can go to our website, thisdayinmusic.com. It's all on there. And while you're there, you can see which song was number one on the day you were born. What's yours, Giles?
I haven't looked it on the day I was born. I haven't actually looked, actually. I shall do that right. Why don't I do that right now if it'll let me know? Because it is, as a broadcaster, he says, going into his radio voice, it is a service that I do. Let me have a look. Hang on, this is live radio. Hang on, let's have a look.
Well, because you were probably born in what, 1970, what, two?
Oh, no, 1968, mate. but nice. Thank you for that. I'm just looking. Day in music. This day in music. I'm sure it'll probably come up with a blocking thing now for me. There we go. This day in music. On this day. Birthday number one. Easy to navigate. Yes. Oh, blimey. The very hard Bob Dylan music quiz. We'll be looking at that a bit later. Let's have a look, though. Birthday. Where? Born on birthday number one. Here we go. Top left, next to home. Live radio.
Right. You should see a giant jukebox.
I can.
Enter your date
of birth. Luckily, I'm born in January, so that'll keep it relatively quick, I think. Come on, work your... Yeah. Oh, there you go. Smoothly, right. It's going to be something... Trying to be all hip and whatever. It's going to come something like... It'll probably be something like, I don't know, Sandy Shore or something. Right, then, 19th of January, 1968. Show me the number one. It's very swish. And the number one was... Georgie Fame. Yeah.
Oh.
Georgie Fame in the UK, The Ballad of Bonnie and Clyde. There you go.
Oh, well.
And you've got a little bit of a bio there. And at number one in the States, blimey, you've got them all here, haven't you? You've got John Fred and his Playboy band, Judy in Disguise with Glasses. Ah, the take of Lucy in the Sky.
Oh,
I remember that one. Yeah. And yeah. And number one in Germany was the Bee Gees and Massachusetts.
Ah, well.
So there you go.
you've, You've got three great songs there, Giles.
I've got three great songs, which I'll listen to on the car on the way home, but thanks. But in the meantime, I think we'll play out with a Smith song that actually meant an awful lot to me as a lonely something teen-year-old boy in Stoke with a one-bar fire. Listening to this on the radio seemed to sum it all up for me. The song is How Soon Is Now. I'll probably cry on the way home too. The book, however, is called The Smiths, The Day I Was There. It's thoroughly recommended. It's by Neil Coyser. Neil, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Giles. Lovely to talk to you.